Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Shut Room by Henry S. Whitehead. It was Sunday morning, and I was coming out of All Saints Church, Margaret Street, along with the other members of the hushed and reverent congregation, when near the entrance doors a hand fell lightly on my shoulder. Turning, I perceived that it was the Earl of Carruth. I nodded without speaking, for there is that in the atmosphere of this great church, especially after one of its magnificent services and heart-searching sermons, which precludes anything like the hum of conversation, which one meets with in many places of worship. In these worldly and scientific days, it is unusual to meet with a person of Lord Carruth's intellectual, scientific attainments who troubles very much about religion. As for me, Gerald Canavan, I have always been a church-going fellow. Carruth accompanied me in silence through the entrance doors and out into Margaret Street. Then, linking his arm in mine, he guided me, still in silence, to where his Rolls-Royce car stood at the curbstone. "Have you any luncheon engagement, Mr. Canavan?" he inquired, when we were just beside the car, the footman holding the door open. "None whatever," I replied. "Then do me the pleasure of lunching with me," invited Carruth. "I was planning on driving from church to your rooms," he explained as soon as we were seated, and the car whirling us noiselessly towards his own house in Mayfair. "A rather extraordinary matter has come up, and Sir John has asked me to look into it. Should you care to hear about it?" "Delighted," I agreed, and settled myself to listen. To my surprise, Lord Carruth began reciting a portion of the Nicene Creed, to which, sung very beautifully by All Saints Choir, we had recently been listening. "Maker of heaven and earth," quoted Carruth musingly, "and of all things, visible and invisible." I started forward in my seat. He had given a peculiar emphasis to the last word, invisible. "A fact," I ejaculated, "constantly forgotten by the critics of religion. The church has always recognized the existence of the invisible creation." "Right, Mr. Canavan. And this invisible creation, it doesn't mean merely angels." "No one who has lived in the West Indies can doubt that," I replied. "Nor in India," countered Carruth. "The fact that the creed attributes to God the authorship of an invisible creation is an interesting commentary on the much-quoted remark of Hamlet to Horatio, 'There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamed of in your philosophy.' Apparently, Horatio's philosophy, like that of the present day, took little account of the spiritual side of affairs, left out God and what he has made. Perhaps Horatio had cited the creed 1,000 times and never realized what that clause implies." "I've thought of it often myself," said I. "And now I am all curiosity. What, please, is the application?" "It is an odd occurrence in one of the old coaching inns," began Carruth, "on the Brighton Road. A very curious matter. It appears that the proprietor, a gentleman, by the way, Mr. William Snow, purchased the inn for an investment just after the armistice, has been having a rather unpleasant time of it. It has to do with shoes." "Shoes?" I inquired. "Shoes?" It seemed an abrupt transition from the Nicene Creed to shoes. "Yes," replied Carruth. "And not only shoes, but all sorts of leather affairs. In fact, the last and chief difficulty was about the disappearance of a commercial traveler's leather sample case. But I perceive we are arriving home. We can continue the account at luncheon." During lunch, he gave me a rather full account with details of what had happened at the Coach and Horses Inn on the Brighton Road, an account which I will briefly summarize as follows. Snow, the proprietor, had bought the old inn partly for business reasons, partly for sentimental. It had been a portion, up to about a century before, of his family's landed property. He had repaired and enlarged it, modernize it in some ways, and in general restored a much run-down institution, making the coach and horses into a paying investment. He had retained, so far as possible, the antique architectural features of the old coaching inn, and before very long had built up a motor clientele of large proportions by sound and careful management. Everything, in fact, had prospered with the gentleman innkeeper's affairs until there began, some 4 months back, a series of unaccountable disappearances. The objects which had, as it were, vanished into thin air were all, and this seemed to me the most curious and bizarre feature of Curlew's recital, leather articles. Pair after pair of shoes or boots, left outside bedroom doors at night, would be gone the next morning. Actually, the boots were suspected of theft, but the boots had been able to prove his innocence easily enough. He was, it seemed, a rather intelligent, broken-down jockey, of a keen wit. He had assured Mr. Snow of his surprise as well as of his innocence, and suggested that he take a week's holiday to visit his aged mother in Kent, and that a substitute boots, chosen by the proprietor, should take his place. Snow agreed, and the disappearance of guest footwear had continued, to the consternation of the substitute, a total stranger obtained from a London agency. That exonerated Billings the jockey, who came back to his duties at the end of his holiday with his character as an honest servant intact. Moreover, the disappearance had not been confined to boots and shoes. Pocketbooks, leather luggage, backs, cigarette cases, all sorts of leather articles went the way of the earlier boots and shoes, and besides the expense and annoyance of replacing this, Mr. Snow began to be seriously concerned about the reputation of his house. An inn in which one's leather belongings are known to be unsafe would not be a very strong financial asset. The matter had come to a head through the disappearance of the commercial traveler's sample case, as noted by Carruth in his first brief account of this mystery. The main difficulty in this affair was that the traveler had been a salesman of jewelry, and Snow had been confronted with a bill for £700, which he had felt constrained to pay. After that, he had laid the mysterious matter before Sir John Scott, head of Scotland Yard. And Scott had called in Carruth because he recognized in Snow's story certain elements which caused him to believe this was no case for mere criminal investigation. After lunch, Carruth ordered the car again, and after stopping at my rooms for some additional clothing and the other necessities for an overnight visit, we started along the Brighton Road for the scene of the difficulty. We arrived about 4 that Sunday afternoon and immediately went into conference with the proprietor. Mr. William Snow was a youngish, middle-aged gentleman, very well dressed and obviously a person of intelligence and natural attainments. He gave us all the information possible, repeating with many details the matters which I have already summarized, while we listened in silence when he had finished. "I should like to ask some questions," said Carruth. "I am prepared to answer anything you wish to inquire about," Mr. Snow assured us. "Well, then, about the sentimental element in your purchase of the inn, Mr. Snow. Tell us, if you please, what you may know of the more ancient history of this old hostelry. I've no doubt there is history connected with it, situated where it is. Undoubtedly, in the coaching days of the Four Georges, it must have been the scene of many notable gatherings." "You are right, Lord Carruth. As you know, it was a portion of the property of my family. All the old registers are intact and are at your disposal. It is an inn of very ancient foundation. It was indeed old in those days of the Four Georges to whom you refer. The records go back well into the 16th century, in fact, and there was an inn here even before registers were kept. They are of comparatively modern origin, you know. Your ancient landlord kept, I imagine, only his reckoning. He was not concerned with records. Even licenses are comparatively modern, you know. The registers were produced, a set of bulky, dry-smelling, calf-bound volumes. There were 8 of them." Carruth and I looked at each other with a mutual shrug. "I suggest," said I after a slight pause, "that perhaps you, Mr. Snow, may already be familiar with the contents of these. I should imagine it might require a week or two of pretty steady application even to go through them cursorily." Mr. William Snow smiled. "I was about to offer to mention the high points," said he. "I've made a careful study of these old volumes, and I can undoubtedly save you both a great deal of reading. The difficulty is What shall I tell you? If only I knew what to put my finger upon. But I do not, you see. Perhaps we can manage that, threw in Caruth. But first, may we not have Billings in and question him? The former jockey, now the boots at the Coach and Horses, was summoned and proved to be a wizened, copper-faced individual, with a keen eye and a deferential manner. Caruth invited him to a seat, and he sat gingerly on the very edge of the chair while we talked with him. I will make no attempt to reproduce his accent, which is quite beyond me. His account was somewhat as follows, omitting the questions asked him by both Caruth and myself. At first it was only boots and shoes. Then other things began to go. The things always disappeared at night. Nothing ever disappeared before midnight, because I've sat up and watched many at the time. Yes, we tried everything, watching, even tying up the leather things, traps. Yes, sir, steel traps, baited with a boot. Twice we did that. Both times the boot was gone in the morning, the trap not even sprung. No, sir, no one possibly among the servants. Yet, an inside job, it couldn't have been otherwise. From all over the house, yes. My old riding boots, two pairs, gone completely, not a trace, right out of my room. That was when I was down in Kent, as Mr. Snows told you, gentlemen. The man who took my place slept in my room, left the door open one night. Boots gone in the morning, right under his nose. Seen anything? Well, sir, in a manner, yes. In a manner, no. To be precise, no. I can't say that I ever saw anything, that is, anybody. No, nor any apparatus, as you might say, in a manner of speaking. No hooks, no strings, nothing used to take hold of the things, but... Here Billings hesitated, glanced at his employer, looked down at his feet, and his coppery face turned a shade redder. Gentlemen, said he as though coming to a resolution, I can only tell you the God's truth about it. You may think me barmy, shouldn't blame you if you did, but I'm as much interested in this here thing as Mr. Snow himself, Baron, that I haven't had to pay the score, make up the value of the things, I mean, as he is. I'll tell you, so help me God, gentlemen, it's a fact. I have seen something absurd, as it'll seem to you. I've seen... Billings hesitated once more, dropped his eyes, looked distressed, glanced at all of us in the most shamefaced, deprecating manner imaginable, twiddled his hands together, looked, in short, as though he were about to own up to that he was, after all, responsible for the mysterious disappearances, then finally said, I've seen things disappear through the air. Now, it's out. But it's a fact, gentlemen. Also, help me, it's the truth. Through the air, just as if someone were carrying them away. Someone invisible, I mean, in a manner of speaking. Bloomin' pair of boots swinging along through the bloomin' air, enough to make a man say his prayers for a fact. It took considerable assuring on the part of Caruth and myself to convince the man Billings that neither of us regarded him as demented or, as he pithily expressed it, barmy. We assured him, while our host sat looking at his servant with a slightly puzzled frown, that on the contrary we believed him implicitly, and furthermore, that we regarded his statement as distinctly helpful. Mr. Snow, obviously convinced that something in his diminutive servitor's mental works was unhinged, almost demurred to our request that we go forthwith and examine the place in the hotel where Billingsley alleged his marvel to have occurred. We were conducted up two flights of winding steps to the story, which had in the inn's older days plainly been an attic. There Billingsley indicated was the scene of the disappearance of the blooming boot, swinging along unaccompanied through the blooming air. It was a sunny corridor, lighted by the spring sunlight through several quaint old-fashioned mullion windows. Billings showed us where he had sat on a stool in the corridor, watching, indicated the location of the boots, outside a doorway of one of the less expensive guest rooms, traced for us the route taken by the disappearing boots. This route led us around the corner of the corridor, a corner which the honest Books assured us he had been too frightened to negotiate on the dark night of the alleged marble. But we went around it, and there, in a small, right-angled hallway, it became at once apparent to us that the boots on that occasion must have gone through one of two doorways, opposite each other at either side, or else vanished into thin air. Mr. Snow, in answer to our remarks on this subject, Through opening the door at the right, it led into a small but sunny and very comfortable-looking bedchamber, shining with honest cleanliness and decorated tastefully, with chintz curtains, with valances, and containing several articles of pleasant antique furniture. This room, as a repository of air-traveling boots, seemed unpromising. We looked in silence. "And what is on the other side of this short corridor?" I inquired. "The shut room," replied Mr. Williamsnow. "The shut room?" Carruth and I looked at each other. "Explain, please," said Carruth. "It is merely a room which has been kept shut, except for an occasional cleaning," replied our host readily. "For more than a century, there was, as a matter of fact, a murder committed in it in the year 1818, and it was thereafter disused. When I purchased the inn, I kept it shut, partly, I dare say, for sentimental reasons, partly perhaps because it seemed to me a kind of asset for an ancient hostelry. It has been known as the shut room for more than 100 years. There was, otherwise, no reason why I should not have put the room in use. I am not in the least superstitious." "When was the room last opened?" I inquired. "It was cleaned about 10 days ago, I believe," answered Mr. Snow. "May we examine it?" asked Carruth. "Certainly," agreed Snow, and forthwith set Billings after the key. "And may we hear the story, if you know the details, of the murder to which you referred?" Carruth asked. "Certainly," said Snow again, "but it is a long and rather complicated story. Perhaps it would do better during dinner." In this decision we agreed, and Billings returned with a key. Snow unlocked the door, and we looked into the shut room. It was quite empty, and the blinds were drawn down over the two windows. Carruth raised these, letting in a flood of sunlight. The room was utterly characterless to all appearance, but I confess a certain sensitivity in such matters. I felt something like a faint, ominous chill. It was not, as the word I have used suggests, anything like physical cold. It was, so to express it mentally, cold. I despair of expressing what I mean more clearly. We looked over the entire room, an easy task, as there was absolutely nothing to attract the eye. Both windows were in the wall at our right hand as we entered, and save for the entrance door through which we had just come, the other three walls were quite blank. Carruth stepped halfway out through the doorway and looked at the width of the hall in which the door was set. It was perhaps 10 inches thick. He came back into the room, measured with his glance the distance from window wall to the blank wall opposite the windows, again stepped outside, into the passageway this time, and along it until he came to this place where the short passage turned into the longer corridor from which we had entered. He turned to his right this time. I followed him curiously, that is, in the direction opposite that from which we had walked along the corridor, and tapped lightly on the wall there. "About the same thickness, what?" he inquired of Snow. "I believe so," came the answer. "We can easily measure it." "No, it will not be necessary, I think. We know that it is approximately the same." Carruth ceased speaking, and we followed him back into the room once more. He walked straight across it, rapped on the wall opposite the doorway. "And how thick is this wall?" he inquired. "It is impossible to say," replied Snow, looking slightly mystified. "You see, there are no rooms on that side. Only the outer wall, and no window through which we could easily estimate the thickness. I suppose it is the same as the others, about 10 inches, I imagine." Carruth nodded and led the way out into the hallway once more. Snow looked inquiringly at Carruth, then at me. "It may as well be locked again," offered Carruth, "but I'd be grateful if you'd allow me to keep the key until tomorrow." Snow handed him the key without comment, but a slight look of puzzlement was on his face as he did so. Carruth offered no comment, and I thought it wise to defer the question, which was on my lips until later when we were alone. We started down the long corridor toward the staircase, Billings touching his forehead and stepping on ahead of us, and disappearing rapidly down the stairs, doubtless to his interrupted duties in the scullery. "It is time to think of which rooms you would prefer," suggested our pleasant-voiced host as we neared the stairs. "Suppose I show you some which are not occupied, and you may, of course, choose what suit you best." "On this floor, if you please," said Carruth positively. "As you wish, of course," agreed Snow. "But the better rooms are on the floor below. Would you not perhaps prefer?" "Thank you, no," answered Carruth. "We shall prefer to be up here, if we may, and, if convenient, a large room with two beds. "That can be managed very easily," agreed Snow. He stepped back a few paces along the corridor and opened a door. A handsome large room, very comfortably and well furnished, came to our view. Its excellence spoke well for the management of the coach and horses. The better rooms must indeed be palatial. This was a fair sample of the somewhat less desirable. "This will answer admirably," said Carruth, directing an eyebrow at me. I nodded hastily. I was eager to agree in anything he might have in mind. "Then we shall call it settled," remarked Snow. "I shall have your things brought up at once. Perhaps you would like to remain here now." "Thank you," said Carruth. "What time do we dine?" "At 7, if you please. Or late, if you prefer. I'm having a private room for the three of us." "That will answer splendidly," agreed Carruth. And I added a word of agreement. Mr. Snow hurried off to attend to the sending up of our small luggage, and Carruth drew me at once into the room. "I'm a little more than anxious," he began, "to hear the tale of the murder. It is an extraordinary step forward. Do you not agree with me that Billings' account of the disappearing boots through the air should fit so neatly and unexpectedly into their going around that corner of the corridor where the shut room is? It sets us forward, I imagine. What is your impression, Mr. Canavan?" "I agree with you heartily," said I. "The only point on which I am not clear is the matter of the thickness of the walls. Is there anything in that?" "If you will allow me, I'll defer that explanation until we have had the account of the murder at dinner," said Carruth, "and our things arriving at that moment, we set about preparing for dinner." Dinner in a small, beautifully furnished private room did more, if anything more were needed, to convince me that Mr. William Snow's reputation as a successful modern innkeeper had been well earned. It was a thoroughly delightful meal in all respects, but that in a general way is really all that I can remember about it, because my attention was wholly occupied in taking in every detail of the strange story which our host unfolded to us, beginning with the fish course. I think it was a fried sole, and which ended only when we were sipping the best coffee I had tasted since my arrival in England from our United States. "In the year 1818, said Mr. Snow, "near the end of the long reign of King George III, the king, you will remember, Mr. Canavan, who gave you Americans your 4th of July, this house was kept by one James Titmarsh. Titmarsh was a very old man. It was his boast that he had taken over the landlordship in the year that his most gracious majesty, George III, had come to the throne, and that he would last as long as the king reigned. That was in the year 1760, and George III had been reigning for 58 years. Old Titmarsh, you see, must have been somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 himself. Titmarsh was something of a character. For some years, the actual management of the inn had devolved upon his nephew, Oliver Titmarsh, who was middle-aged and none too respectful, though apparently an able taverner. Old Titmarsh, if tradition is to be believed, had many a row with his deputy, but being himself childless, he was more or less dependent upon Oliver, who consorted with low company for choice and did not bear the best of reputation in the community. Old Titmarsh's chief bugbear in connection with Oliver was the latter's friendship with Simon Forrester. Forrester lacked only a bard to be immortal, but there was no Cowper to his John Gilpin, so to speak. No writer of the period, nor indeed since, has chosen to set forth Forrester's exploits. Nevertheless, these were highly notable. Forrester was the very kingpin of the highwaymen, operating with extraordinary success and daring along the much-traveled Brighton Road. Probably old Titmarsh was philosopher enough to ignore his nephew's association and act so long as he attended to the business of the inn. The difficulty in connection with Forrester was that Forrester, an extraordinarily bold fellow, whose long immunity from the gallows had caused him to believe himself possessed of a kind of charmed life, constantly resorted to the coach and horses, which, partly because of its convenient location, and partly because of its good cheer, he made his house of call. During the evening of the 1st of June in the year 1818, a royal courier paused at the coach and horses for some refreshment and a fresh mount. This gentleman carried one of the old king's peremptory messages to the Prince of Wales, then sojourning at Brighton, and who, under his sobriquet of First Gentleman of Europe, was addicted to a life which sadly irked his royal parent at Whitehall. It was an open secret that only Prince George's importance to the realm as heir apparent to the throne prevented some very drastic action being taken against him for his innumerable follies and extravagances on the part of King and Parliament. This, you will recall, was 2 years before the old king died, and the first gentleman came to the throne as George IV. The royal messenger, Sir William Greaves, arriving about 9 in the evening, after a hard ride, went into the coffee room to save the time which the engagement and preparation of a private room would involve, and when he paid his score he showed a purse full of broad gold pieces. He did not know that Simon Forrester, sitting behind him over a great mug of mulled port, took careful note of this unconscious display of wealth and ready money. Sir William delayed no longer than necessary to eat a chop and drink a pot of six ale, then his spurs clanking he took his departure. He was barely out of the room before Forrester, his wits, perhaps, affected by the potentations which he had been imbibing, called for his own mount, Black Bess, and rose slightly stumbling to his feet to speed the potboy on his way to the stables. "You'd not be harrying a royal messenger, God's sake, Simon," protested his companion, who was no less a person than Oliver Titmarsh, seizing his crony by his ruffled sleeve of lace satin. "Unhand me," thundered Forrester, then boastfully, "There's no power in England will stay Slim Forrester when he chooses to take the road." Somewhat unsteadily, he strode to the door and roared his commands to the stable boy, who was not leading Black Bess rapidly enough to suit his drunken humor. Once in the saddle, the fumes of the wine he had drunk seemed to evaporate. Without a word, Simon Forrester set out, sitting his good mare like a statue in the wake of Sir William Greaves toward Brighton. The coffee room, as Oliver Titmarsh turned back into it from the doorway whither he had accompanied Forrester, seethed into an uproar. Freed from the dominating presence of the truculent ruffian, who would as soon slit a man's throat as look him in the eye, along with sights of his horse pistol from behind the black mask, the numerous guests silent before had found their tongues. Oliver Titmarsh sought to drown out their clamor of protest, but before he could succeed, old Titmarsh, attracted by the unwonted noise, had hobbled down the short flight of steps from his private cubbyhole and entered the room. It required only a moment, despite Oliver's now frantic efforts to stem the tide of comment, before the old man had grasped the purport of what was toward. Oliver secured comparative silence, then urged his aged uncle to retire. The old man did so, muttering helplessly, internally cursing his age and feebleness, which made it out of the question for him to regulate the scandal which had originated in his inn. A king's messenger, then as now, was sacred in the eyes of all decent citizens. A king's messenger to be called on to stand and deliver by the villainous Forrester, it was too much. Muttering and grumbling, the old man left the room, but instead of going back to his easy chair and his pipe and glass, he stepped out through the kitchens, without so much as a lantern to light his path, groped his way to the stable. A few minutes later, the sound of horses' hoofs in the cobbled stable yard brought a pause in the clamor which had once more broken out and now raged in the coffee room. Listening, those in the coffee room heard the animal trot out through the gate and the diminishing sound of its galloping as it took the road towards Brighton. Oliver Titmarsh rushed to the door, but the horse and its rider were already out of sight. Then he ran up to his ancient uncle's room, only to find the crafty old man apparently dozing in his chair. He hastened to the stables. One of the grooms was gone, and the best saddle horse. From the others, duly warned by old Titmarsh, he could elicit nothing. He returned to the coffee room in a towering rage, and forthwith cleared it, driving his guest out before him in a protesting herd. Then he sat down alone, a fresh bottle before him, to await developments. It was more than an hour later when he heard the distant beat of a galloping horse's hoofs through the quiet June night, and a few minutes later Simon Forrester rode into the stable-yard and cried out for an hostler for his Beth. He strode into the coffee-room a minute later, a smirk of satisfaction on his ugly, scarred face. Seeing his crony, Oliver, alone, he drew up a chair opposite him, removed his coat, hung it over the back of his chair, and placed over its back, where the coat hung, the elaborate leather harness consisting of cross-straps and holsters, which he always wore. From the holsters protruded the grip of Jem and Jack, as Forrester had humorously named his twin horse pistols, huge weapons, splendidly kept, each of which threw an ounce ball. Then drawing back the chair, he sprawled in it at his case, fixing on Oliver Titmarsh an evil grin, and bellowing loudly for wine. "For," he protested, "my throat is full of the dust of the road, Oliver, and lad, there's enough to settle the score, never doubt me." And not upon the table, he cast the bulging purse which Sir William Greaves had momentarily displayed when he paid his score an hour and a half back. Oliver Titmarsh, horrified at this evidence that his crony had actually dared to molest the king's messenger, glanced hastily and fearfully about him. But the room, empty and silent, save for their own presence, held no prying, inimical informer. He began to urge upon Forrester the desirability of retiring. It was approaching 11 o'clock, and while the coffee room was fortunately empty, no one knew who might enter from the road or come down from one of the guest rooms at any moment. He shoved the bulging purse, heavy with its broad gold pieces, across the table to his crony, beseeching him to pocket it, but Forrester, drunk with the pride of his exploit, which was unique among the depredations of the road's gentry, boasted loudly and tossed off glass after glass of the heavy port wine a trembling potboy had fetched him. Then Oliver's entreaties were supplemented from an unexpected source. Old Titmarsh, entering through a door in the rear wall of the coffee room, came silently and leaned over the back of the ruffian's chair and added a persuasive voice to his nephew's entreaties. "Best go up to bed now, Simon, my lad," croaked the old man, wheedlingly patting the bulky shoulders of the hulking ruffian with his palsied old hands. Forrester, surprised, turned his head and goggled at the greybeard. Then, with a great laugh, and tossing off a final bumper, he rose unsteadily to his feet and thrust his arms into the sleeves of the fine coat, which old Titmarsh, having detached from the back of the chair, held out to him. I'll go, old gaffer," he kept repeating as he struggled into his coat with mock jocularity. "Seeing you're so careful of me, gad's hooks, I might as well. There'll be no more purses to rook this night, it seems." And with this, pocketing the purse and taking over his arm the pistol harness which the old man thrust at him, the villain lumbered up the stairs to his accustomed room. "Do thou go after him, Oliver," urged the old man. "I'll bide here and lock the doors. There'll likely be no further custom this night." Oliver Titmarsh, sobered perhaps by his fears, followed Forrester up the stairs, and the old man, crouched in one of the chairs, waited and listened, his ancient ears cocked against a certain sound he was expecting to hear. It came within a quarter of an hour of the distant beat of the hoofs of horses, many horses. It was indeed as though a considerable company approached the coach and horses along the Brighton Road. Old Titmarsh smiled to himself and crept toward the inn doorway. He laboriously opened the great oaken door and peered into the night. The sound of many hoofbeats was now clearer, plainer. Then abruptly, the hoofbeats died on the calm June air. Old Titmarsh, somewhat puzzled, listened tremblingly. Then he smiled in his beard once more. Strategy this. Someone with a head on his shoulders was in command of that troop. They had stopped at some distance, lest the hoofbeats should alarm their quarry. A few minutes later, the old man heard the muffled sound of careful footfalls, and within another minute, a king's officer in his red coat had crept up beside him. "He's within," whispered old Titmarsh, "and well gone by now in his damned drunkard slumber. Summon the troopers. Sir, I'll lead you to where the villain sleeps. He hath the purse of his majesty's messenger upon him. What need ye of better evidence?" "Nay," replied the train band captain in a similar whisper, "that evidence even is not required. We have but now taken up the dead body of Sir William Greaves beside the high road, and now spalled through his honest heart. 'Tis a case this of drawing and quartering, Titmarsh, thanks to your good offices in sending your boy for me." The troopers gradually assembled. When 8 had arrived, the captain, preceded by old Titmarsh, and followed in turn by his trusty 8, mounted the steps to where Forrester slept. It was, as you have guessed, the empty room you examined this afternoon, the shut room of this house. At the foot of the upper stairs, the captain addressed his men in a whisper. "A desperate man, this, lads. Wear bullets. Yet he must needs be taken alive, for the assizes are much credit to them that take him. He hath been a pest of the road, as well you know, these many years agone. Upon him, then, ere he rises from his drunken sleep. He hath partaken heavily. Pounce upon him ere he rises." A mutter of agreement came from the troopers. They tightened their belts and stepped alertly silently after their leader, preceded by their ancient guide, carrying a pair of candles. Arrived at the door of the room, the captain disposed his men, and crying out in the king's name, for these stout fellows threw themselves against the door. It gave way at once under that massed impact, and the men rushed into the room, dimly lit by old Titmarsh's candle. Forrester, his eyes blinking evilly in the candlelight, was halfway out of bed when they got into the room. He slept. He was accustomed to boast with one eye open, drunk or sober. Throwing off the coverlid, the highwayman leaped for the chair over the back of which hung his fine lace coat, the holsters uppermost. He plunged his hands into the holsters and stood for an instant the very picture of baffled amazement. The holsters were empty. Then, as four stalwart troopers flung themselves upon him to bear him to the floor, there was heard old Titmarsh's harsh, senile cackle. "'Twas I that robbed ye, ye villain. Took your pretty boys, your gem, and your jack out of the holsters while you were struggling into your fine coat. You'll not abide in a decent house beyond this night, I'm thinking. And 'twas the old man who did for ye, murdering wretch that you are." A terrific struggle ensued. With or without his pretty boys, Simon Forrester was thoroughly a tough customer, versed in every sleight of hand-to-hand fighting. He bit and kicked, he elbowed and gouged. He succeeded in hurling one of the troopers bodily against a blank wall, and the man sank there and lay still, a motionless heap. After a terrific struggle with the other three who had cast themselves upon him, the remaining troopers and their captain standing aside, because there was not room to get at him in the melee, he succeeded in getting the forefinger of one of the troopers who had reached for a face hold upon him between his teeth and bit through it at the joint. Frantic with rage and pain, this trooper, disengaging himself, and before he could be stopped, seized a heavy oaken bench and, swinging it through the air, brought it down on Simon Forrester's skull. No human bones, even Forrester, could sustain that murderous assault. The tough wood crunched through his skull, and thereafter he lay quiet. Simon Forrester would never be drawn and quartered, nor even hanged. Simon Forrester, ignobly as he had lived, was dead, and it remained for the troopers only to carry out the body and for their captain to indict his report. Thereafter, the room was stripped and closed by old Titmarsh himself, who lived on for 2 more years, making good his frequent boast that his reign over the coach and horses would equal that of King George III over his realm. The old king died in 1820, and old Titmarsh did not long survive him. Oliver, now a changed man, because of this occurrence, succeeded to the lease of the inn, and during his landlordship, the room remained closed. It has been closed, out of use ever since. Mr. Snow brought his story and his truly excellent dinner to a close at the same time. It was I who broke the little silence which followed his concluding words. "I congratulate you, sir, upon the excellence of your narrative gift. I hope that if I come to record this affair, as I have already done with respect to certain odd happenings which have come under my view, I shall be able, as nearly as possible, to reproduce your words." I bowed to our host over my coffee cup. "Excellent, excellent indeed," added Carruth, nodding and smiling pleasantly in Mr. Snow's direction. "And now, for the questions, if you don't mind, there are several which have occurred to me, doubtless also to Mr. Canavan." Snow agreed affably. "Anything you cared to ask, of course." "Well, then," it was Carruth to whom I had indicated precedence in the questioning, "tell us, if you please, Mr. Snow. You seem to have every particular at your finger ends, the purse of the gold, that I suppose was confiscated by the train band captain and eventually found its way back to Sir William Greaves' heirs. That is the high probability, but do you happen to know, as a matter of fact, the purse went back to Lady Greaves?" "Ah, and Forrester's effects. I understand he used a room from time to time. Did he have anything, any personal property in it? If so, what became of it?" "It was destroyed, burned. No one claimed his effects. Perhaps he had no relatives. Possibly no one dared to come forward. Everything in his possession was stolen, or, what is the same, the fruit of his thefts. And the pistols, Jem and Jack. Those names rather intrigued me. What disposition was made of them, if you happen to know? Old Titmarsh had them, of course, concealed somewhere, probably in that cubbyhole of his which you mentioned." "Ah," said Mr. Snow, rising, "there I can really give you some evidence. The pistols are in my office, in the Chubb safe, along with the holster apparatus. the harness which Forrester wore under his lace coat. I will bring them in. Have you the connection, Mr. Canavan? Lord Carruth inquired of me as soon as Snow had left the dining room. Yes, said I. The connection is clear enough, clear as a pikestaff, to use one of your time-honored British expressions, although I confess never to have seen a pikestaff in my life. But apart from the fact that the holsters are made of leather, the well-known background of the unfulfilled desire persisting after death, and the obvious connection between the point of disappearance of those walking boots of Billings with a shut room, I must confess myself at a loss. The various tyro at this sort of thing would connect those points, I imagine. There it is, laid out for us, directly before mental eye, so to speak. But what I fail to understand is not so much as to who takes them, that, by a long stretch of the imagination, may very well be the persistent shade, Ka, projected embodiment of Simon Forrester. No. What gets me is, where does the carrier boots and satchels and jewels, sample cases, put them? That room is utterly, absolutely, physically empty, and boots and shoes are material affairs, Lord Carruth. Carruth nodded gravely. You have put your finger on the main difficulty, Mr. Canavan. I'm not at all sure that I can explain, even if we are able to solve the mystery at all. My experience in India does not help, but there is one very vague case right here in England, which may be a parallel one. I suspect, not to put too fine a point upon the matter, that the abstracted things may very well be behind that rearmost wall, the wall opposite the doorway in the shut room. But I interjected, that is impossible, is it not? The wall is material, brick and stone and plaster. It is not subject to the strange laws of personality. How? The return of the gentleman landlord of the coach and horses at this moment put an end to our conversation, but not to my wonder. I imagine that the case alluded to by my companion would be that of the tortured ghost of the jester, which, with a revenge motive, haunted a room in an ancient house, and even managed to equip the room itself with some of its revengeful properties or motives. The case had been recorded by Mr. Hodgson, and later Carruth told me that this was the one he had in mind. This, it seemed to me, was a very different matter. However, Mr. Snow laid the elaborate and beautifully made harness of leather straps out on the table beside the after-dinner coffee service. The grips of Jem and Jack peeped out of their holsters. The device was not unlike those used by our American desperados, men like the famous Earp brothers and Doc Holliday, whose six guns were carried handily in slung holsters in front of the body. We examined these antique weapons, murderous-looking pistols of the bulldog type, built for business, and Carruth ascertained that neither Jem nor Jack was loaded. "Is there anyone else on that top floor?" inquired Carruth. "No one save yourselves, excepting some of the servants who are in the other end of the house," returned Snow. "I'm going to request you to let us take these pistols and the harness with us upstairs when we retire," said Carruth, and again the obliging Snow agreed. "Everything I have is at your disposal, gentlemen," said he, "in the hope that you will be able to end this annoyance for me. It is too early in the season at present for the inn to have many guests. Do precisely as you wish in all ways." Shortly after 9 o'clock, we took leave of our pleasant host, and carrying the harness and pistols, divided between us, we mounted to our commodious bedchamber. A second bed had been moved into it, and the fire in the grate took off the slight chill of the spring evening. We began our preparations by carrying the high-powered electric torches we had obtained from Snow along the corridor and around the corner to the shut room. We unlocked the door and ascertained that the two torches would be quite sufficient to work by. Then we closed but did not lock the door and returned to our room. Between us, we moved a solidly built oak table to a point diagonally across the corridor from our open bedroom door, and on this we placed the harness and pistols. Then, well provided with smoke materials, we sat down to wait, seated in such positions that both of us could command the view of our trap. It was during the conversation which followed that Carruth informed me that the case to which he had alluded was the one recorded by the occult writer Hodgson. It was familiar to both of us. I will not cite it. It may be read by anybody who has a curiosity to examine it in the collection entitled Carnacki the Ghost Finder, by William Hope Hodgson. In that account, it is the floor of the haunted room which became adapted to the revenge motive of the persistent shade of the malignant court jester tortured to death many years before his manifestation by his fiendish lord and master. We realized that according to the man Billings' testimony, we need not be on alert before midnight. Carruth, therefore, read from a small book which he had brought with him, and I busied myself in making the careful notes which I have consulted in recording Mr. Snow's narrative of Simon Forrester, while that narrative was fresh in my memory. It was a quarter before midnight when I had finished. I took a turn about the room to refresh my somewhat cramped muscles and returned to my comfortable chair. Midnight struck from the French clock on our mantelpiece, and Carruth and I both at the signal began to give our entire attention to the articles on the table in the hallway out there. It occurred to me that this joint watching, as intently as the circumstances seemed to warrant to both of us, might prove very wearing, and I suggested that we watch alternately for about 15 minutes each. We did so, I taking the first turn. Nothing occurred, not a sound, not the smallest indication that there might be anything untoward going out there in the corridor. At 12:15, Carruth began to watch the table, and it was, I should imagine, about 5 minutes later that his hand fell lightly on my arm, pressing it and arousing me to the keenest attention. I looked intently at the things on the table. The harness was moving toward the left-hand edge of the table. We could both hear now the slight scraping sound made by the leather weighed by the twin pistols, and even as we looked, the whole apparatus lifted itself, or so it appeared to us, from the supporting table and began, as it were, to float through the air a distance of about 4 feet from the ground toward the turn which led to the shut room. We rose at the same time, for we had planned carefully on what we were to do and followed. We were in time to see the articles float around the corner, and increasing our pace, for we had been puzzled about how anything material like the boots could get through the locked door, watched in the rather dim light of that short hallway what would happen. What happened was that the harness and pistols reached the door, and then the door opened. They went through, and the door shut behind them precisely as though someone invisible to us were carrying them. We heard distinctly the slight sound which a gently closed door makes as it came to, and there we were standing outside in the hallway looking at each other. It was one thing to figure out beforehand the science of occult occurrences, even upon the basis of such experience as Carruth and I both possessed. It is distinctly another to face the direct operation of something motivated by the powers beyond the ordinary ken of humanity. I confessed to certain cold chills, and Carruth's face was very pale. We switched on our electric torches, as we had arranged to do, and Carruth, with a firm hand, which I admired if I did not precisely envy, reached out and turned the knob of the door. We walked into the shut room. Not all our joint experience had prepared us for what we saw. I could not forbear clutching Carruth's free arm, the one not engaged with the torch, as he stood beside me, and I testify that his arm was as still and firm as a rock. It steadied me to realize such fortitude, for the sight which was before us was enough to unnerve the most hardened investigator of the unearthly. Directly in front of us, but facing the blank wall at the far end of the room, stood a half-materialized man. The gleam of my torch threw a faint shadow on the wall in front of him, the rays passing through him as though he were not there, and yet with a certain dimming. The shadow visibly increased in the few brief instants of our utter silence, and then we observed the figure was struggling with something. Mechanically we concentrated both electric rays on the figure, and then we saw clearly. A bulky man with a bull neck and close-cropped iron-gray hair, wearing a fine satin coat and what were called in their day small cloths, or tight-fitting knee trousers, with silk stockings and heavy buckled shoes, while raising and fitting about his waist over the coat the harness with the pistols. Abruptly, the materialization appearing to now be complete, he turned upon us with an audible snarl and baleful, glaring little eyes like a pig's, deep set in a hideous, scarred face, and then he spoke. He spoke, and he had been dead for more than a century. "Ah," he snarled, evilly, "you are coming upon me, my fine gents, into this my bedchamber. I'll teach you manners." And he ended this diatribe with a flood of the foulest language imaginable, stepping with almost mincing down-toed steps toward us all the time he poured out his filthy curses and revilings. I was completely at a loss what to do. I realized these ideas went through my mind with the rapidity of thought that the pistols were unloaded. I told myself that this was some weird hallucination, that the shade of no dead and gone desperado could harm us. Yet it was a truly terrifying experience, be the man shade or true flesh and blood. Then Caruth spoke to him, in quiet, persuasive tones. "But you have your pistols now, Simon Forrester. It was we who put them where you could find them, your pretty boys, Jem and Jack. That was what you were trying to find, was it not? And now you have them. There's nothing further for you to do. You have them. They are just under your hands where you can get them whenever you wish." At this, the specter materialization of Simon Forrester blinked at us, a cunning light in his evil little eyes, and dropped his hands with which he had been gesticulating violently on the grips of the pistols. He grinned evilly and spat in a strange fashion over his shoulder. "Aye," said he, more moderately now, I have 'em. Jemmy and Jack, my trusties, my pretty boys." He fondled the butts with his huge hands that could have strangled an ox, and spat over his shoulder. "There is no necessity for you to remain then, is there?" said Caruth, softly, persuasively. The simulacrum of Simon Forrester frowned, looked a bit puzzled, and nodded its head several times. "You can rest now. Now that you have Jem and Jack," suggested Caruth, almost in a whisper, and as he spoke, Forrester turned away and stepped over to the blank wall at the far side of the room, opposite the doorway, and I could hear Caruth draw his breath softly and feel the iron grip of his fingers on my arm. "Watch," he whispered in my ear, "watch now." The solid wall seemed to wave and buckle before Forrester, almost as though it was not a wall but a sheet of white cloth, held and waved by hands as cloth is waved in a theater to simulate waves. More and more cloth-like the wall became, and as we gazed in this strange sight, the simulacrum of Simon Forrester seemed to become less opaque, to melt and blend in with the wavering wall, which gradually ceased to move. And then he was gone, and the wall was as it had been before. A Monday morning, at Caruth's great and urgent solicitation, Snow assembled a force of laborers, and we watched while they broke down the wall of the shut room opposite the doorway. At last, as Caruth had expected, a pick went through, and the interested workmen, laboring with a will, broke through into a small, narrow, cell-like room, the plasters of which indicated had been walled up perhaps 2 centuries before, or even earlier, a priest hole, in all probability the early post-Reformation period, near the end of the 16th century. Caruth stopped the work as soon as it was plain what was here, and turned out the workmen, who went protestingly. Then, with only our hosts working beside us, and the door of the room locked on the inside, we continued the job. At last the aperture was large enough, and Caruth went through. We heard an exclamation from him, and then he began to hand out articles through the rough hole in the masonry. Leather articles, boots innumerable, ladies' reticules, hand luggage, the missing jeweler's sample case with its contents intact, innumerable other articles, and last of all the harness with the pistols in the holsters. Caruth explained the gesture case to Snow, who shook his head over it. "It's quite beyond me, Lord Caruth," said he. "But as you say, this annoyance is at an end. I am quite satisfied, and I'll take your advice and make sure by pulling down the whole room, breaking out the corridor walls, and joining it to the next room across the way. I confess, I cannot make head or tails of your explanation. The unfulfilled wish, the sympathetic pervasion of the room, as you call it, the materialization, the strange fact that this business began only a short time ago, but I'll do exactly what you have recommended about the room, that is. The restoration of the jeweler's case will undoubtedly make it possible for me to get back the sum I paid Messrs. Hopkins and Barth of Liverpool when it disappeared in my house. Can you give any explanation of why the shade of Forrester remained quiet for a century and more and only started up the other day, so to speak?" "It is because the power to materialize came very slowly," answered Caruth, "coupled as it undoubtedly was with the gradual breaking down of the room's material resistance. It is very difficult to realize the extraordinary force of an unfulfilled wish on the part of a forceful, brutal, wholly selfish personality like Forrester's. It is really what we must call spiritual power, even though the spirituality was a reverse of what we commonly understand by that term. The wish and the force of Forrester's persistent desire, through the century, have been working steadily, and as you have told us, the room has been out of use for more than a century. There were no common everyday affairs to counteract that malign influence, no interruptions, if I make myself clear. Thank you, said Mr. Snow. I do not clearly understand. These matters are outside my province, but I am exceedingly grateful to you both. Our host bowed courteously. Anything that I can possibly do in return. There is nothing, nothing whatever, said Carruth quietly, but, Mr. Snow, there's another problem on your hands, which perhaps you will have some difficulty in solving, and concerning which, to our regret, he looked gravely at me, I fear neither Mr. Canavan, with his experience, nor I with mine, will be able to assist you. And what, pray, is that? Asked Mr. Snow, turning slightly pale. He would, I perceive, be very well satisfied to have his problem behind him. The problem is, said Carruth, even more gravely, I imagine, it is, what disposal are you to make of 58 pairs of assorted boots and shoes? As Snow's relief laughter was the last of the impressions which I took with me as we rode back to London in Carruth's car of the Coach and Horses Inn on the Brighton Road.